So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review.
How was your week?
Okay, woman to woman. I understand about relationships. I mean, I was just watching my ex-husband. And I realized why you must have kept, you know, all of these secrets about the Undertaker quiet for so long. Because, isn't it because you really love him?
I was content with just letting all of this go, just going on with my life. And then out of nowhere, I get this call from Paul Heyman. Now, I don't know how he knew about me and Mark, but he knew.
So, what you're really trying to tell me is, and this is okay, as far as I'm concerned, is that you did have a relationship with The Undertaker, but it was in the past. And all of this stuff about sleeping with The Undertaker 10 days ago and recently having an affair, I mean, that was all a lie. Paul Heyman put you up to telling all that as a lie, right?
Okay, confidential, between you and I. Yes, it was all a lie. Paul Heyman put me up to it, and once he started rolling with the story, I just went along with it. I mean, I do. I want Mark back. And I don't care about some pregnant wife, Sarah. I'll say whatever has to be said, okay? I am gonna get Mark back.
Confidential. You're a lying bitch. Good stuff.
Hey, what is this, like a one life to live, another world? What's the deal?
It's like a soap opera. We are live in Little Rock at the old Tell Arena for No Mercy.
Oh, I'm so full now. How are you feeling?
Probably not. Better? Probably not good enough for Mandarin, but much better.
Oh, well, that's good. One step at a time.
Yeah.
Mandarin should be your goal.
Yeah, I'll work up to that.
Okay.
I just got your list. Yeah.
So none of them appeal.
No, they're fine. I think they're all fine. I think we should probably do See No Evil another time.
Yeah, that's fine. Let's, I'm not in it. I just, it came to me.
Yeah, I know we discussed it earlier, so let's do it another time.
I don't care if we do it next week, but I think it's a good idea every now and then to do one of those, Raw versus Nitros, since they're each 1 hour at that point in time. It's like,
yeah,
it's
sure.
It's 90 minutes total, and it's something different each week that we can just kind of change it up a little, but I don't care whatever you want to do next week is kind of fine with me.
Well, can you think of a good Halloween Havoc?
Oh, I can't think of a good one. I can only think of horrendous Halloween Havocs, but that's part of the fun.
Yeah.
I don't even know if at most we've done like one, so let me see.
This is an interesting one.
94 was a retirement match with Flair and Hogan, as I recall. I think we did 95, which was the monster truck one, which was that one was the best. 97 had that awesome Rey Mysterio, Eddie Guerrero match. 98, I think we did. That one was terrible. I'm not ready to do Vince Russo.
Anyone, you pick.
Okay, let me scan over this stuff during the. Someone asked about doing some kind of Halloween contest. Is there anything you want to do for Halloween?
I don't know. Maybe costume. People.
Do you think people will dress up?
A wrestling costume, some type of like a best. Nah, but you know those are kind of overdone. Aren't they?
Well, you know what? Halloween's not till a week Friday. So maybe if we think of something, we can announce it on Impact or something. Announce the winner the Monday after Halloween.
Some type of costume contest?
Yeah, something like that.
If you're dressing up as a Halloween.
Yeah, and either just post a picture or a video.
Yeah.
Pictures.
Yeah, and we have to, how do we confirm that these are the actual people?
Oh, that's true. You should probably.
Newspaper? Or maybe a sign. No, you hold up a sign.
Yeah, that's good. Hold up a review away sign or something like that. Yeah, that's good. And some wrestling Costume. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Okay, a wrestling costume contest.
Okay. Well, let's announce it then on this show if we already know what we're going to do. It gives people time.
And when do we announce it?
Let's announce the winner on Raw on November 3rd.
Okay.
And that's... Or we can do it on the Impact that... No. Let's do it on the 3rd after Halloween weekend. That'll probably be...
Yeah, easy. You'll have to because people aren't going to dress up until Halloween.
Yeah, that's... That's why you're here, Way. Always stuff like that.
All right, cool.
Okay. Should just leave all this in. This is all the information.
Yeah.
Now you know what we're reviewing next week, what the costume contest is going to be.
We should have just done the review, like, you know, before we recorded it. And we wouldn't have to do anything.
We should try that some week, a very meta review where it's just you and I. Because it's different if we're just talking about it, like,
yeah, and then you recorded that the whole time? Oh wow,
yeah.
Easy.
Look at that! I hit the button. Oops. Surprise, surprise! Be the opposite of us doing a review and not recording.
You should just
instead, just
wear a wire next time, you know, we talk, and then just bring up casually, No Mercy 2002.
Oh snap, Way! Just like the time the second rope in the opening match snapped.
Yes.
Hello and welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting. Surprise. Wei, are you alive?
I'm here.
You sounded Monday night. You gave it a valiant effort on Monday night watching Raw, doing the review. And at the end of it, I was like, you know, Wei seems to be doing better. How are you now? 2 days removed and your illness, has it turned a corner?
Yeah, I'm much better. I decided to take... you know, the Tuesday off at work as well. And, it's been much better. I've been able to, you know, get some good rest. I've been able to eat solid food, which is nice. So on the path to recovery.
And it's just the flu you had? It wasn't any, like, you didn't eat something bad. It's just the flu.
Yeah, pretty sure. I don't think I ate anything bad.
Wow. Well, it's good to hear you're doing better on Tuesday, which is my day off each week. So it's a day I very much look forward to every week. I try not to make any plans on my day off. It's just a day where I don't have to be scheduling stuff, doing podcasts, watching stuff. It's just a day where I can just relax.
Oh, so sorry about this.
No, this, believe me, is the most relaxing part. Because obviously Wei and I were up very, very late on Monday. We do review a Raw and then I post the show, get it up. So it's a rather late, night for me. So here in my condo, I found out on Monday afternoon that, people from our building are coming for the yearly cleaning of our ventilation system. They're going to come to every unit and clean these things, but it's much like when, your cable company is coming to fix your TV or something. They give you a large window of time that they're going to come. Sometime between 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. they said they were going to come. So I always hate that because it's like, well, Christ, it makes you, you know, when can I leave and make sure I'm not home when these people come? And fuck, 9:01 a.m. I'm woken up to this pounding on my door. And then all of a sudden they unlock my door just to come in and I'm getting up. I'm half unconscious at this point from, you know, going to sleep about four and a half hours earlier and the woman's coming in and they just start cleaning here with this giant machine that just, holy fuck. It sounded like a goddamn construction site here in my room, in my condo. So I get up and I'm just standing there. And I'm grabbing some water and just standing there. And the woman informs me, this will take at least half an hour. It's like, half an hour of this? Jesus Christ. And she's like, did we wake you up? I was like, yeah, you woke me up. Sorry. So I just had to stand around for 24 minutes and 56 seconds. I got my stopwatch out as they cleaned, and then they went to the next unit, and this thing was, it was like 3 hours of just this pounding sound here. So that's how my day began, and then I went out, and now I'm back home, and they have thankfully subsided.
Oh, wow.
Horrible Way. I would trade the flu for this sound to have disappeared and not woken me up this morning. It's the worst.
Well, that's just bad timing, you know? I mean, if you had any other day off, I'm sure you'd be grateful that they would come in at a time when you weren't around.
That would be great. I guess in hindsight, better that they come this morning than say around now. I wouldn't be able to record this with you with this. It was so loud in here. There was no way we could have possibly done this with this half hour of inconvenience here. But hey, my ventilation system is fantastic now. It's all clean. It's ready to go for another year.
Mm.
Small miracles.
Yeah. I'm glad you survived the experience.
Yeah. White people. Well, are you ready to dive into No Mercy 2002 from Little Rock, Arkansas?
Yes.
You know, I went back because this was a time period in 2002 when, for whatever reason, I loved to save stuff. And I used to record The Law on Sunday nights on cassette tapes. And I would save the pay-per-views on cassette tapes. And I thought, I was sure I had No Mercy 2002, the show, saved on a cassette. And I went downstairs into the vault and I found the box of all these old cassettes I have of like mixed tapes I made and Law episodes. It's like 10 of them I've got. And they're from 2002, 2003. And what is the one pay-per-view in there I was missing? No Mercy 2002. I was very deflated. I was like, oh, love to hear what people thought of this show the night of in 2002.
Oh, that's too bad.
So that's not coming up on the show, but me and Wei are going to try and move back to the past 12 years ago. 2002, which was a year we heard all over Monday night's edition of Raw, featuring Orton, Cena, and Lesnar, all starting with the company that year on the main roster.
Yeah.
And one of them on this particular pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. What wasn't exactly a glowing time for Orton and Cena as we go back here to this No Mercy event.
No, I mean, they're both on SmackDown, right? Weren't they? They started off on SmackDown, but I don't even know if Orton was really around. I saw none of him, even in highlight form.
I believe Orton was hurt at this point, or he was just so far down on the undercard that he wasn't being utilized, because I remember the big turnaround for him was when he did those RNN injury updates, but that wasn't until the following year. So at this point, as much as Raw really hit home that it was the beginning of the Cena and Orton rivalry and their launch in the WWE, neither off to the greatest of starts in 2002, to the point that John Cena was largely forgotten at this point. This would have been right before that famous Halloween edition of SmackDown where he did the Vanilla Ice getup and pretty much saved his career at that point with that one promo.
Yeah, the two of them were really just kind of very vanilla, generic baby faces when they started off.
Especially Cena. Cena with like the colors to represent whatever city they were in and the matching boots. I mean, this guy was lost, just lost.
Yeah, I wonder what he did with those tights, you know, because he had those colors made for every town. Like when he came to Toronto, he had blue and white tights. And I mean, I just wonder what he had to do with all of them, because he probably has like, what, I don't know, like 100. How many cities are there in North America?
I would think he had no less than 100 of those, because it was always different colors.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking back, the SmackDown going into this pay-per-view was in Toronto. And do you know who worked on, I think it was the Velocity tapings on that particular SmackDown?
John Cena?
Bobby Roode.
No way. Wow.
Yeah. He worked on the, I think it was on the Velocity tapings.
As Bobby Roode?
As Bobby Roode, R-U-D-E, I think, based on the results I read.
Who did he wrestle?
I can't remember off the top of my head. He was putting somebody over. Maybe Jamie Noble, somebody like that. I was at those tapings. I do recall. I don't remember too many specifics about it.
Cool. Very cool.
So there we go. Going into No Mercy.
Oh, here, I have the match. Bobby Roode versus Billy Kidman.
Oh, okay. Kidman.
It's on YouTube.
Well, you can go check that out. It was pre-short hair Bobby Roode. Who knows? Maybe Bobby Roode will be back here in no time, and he will be the next link to the WWE's 2002 talent burst.
Who knows?
So this was during the brand split when they were still having the combined pay-per-views. So you would typically get two title matches per show, and we'd get pretty much the split here between Raw and SmackDown at the time.
Sorry, oh my God. I'm watching this Bobby Roode match, and this guy's got short, blonde hair.
Bobby Roode does?
Yeah.
Oh, now I gotta look at this.
Like, just some of the worst hair I've ever seen. Oh, he looks ridiculous. Oh my god.
Wait, I'm looking at this. I found it.
He's wearing this cape, this purple cape with a...
Oh god.
Oh my god. What
you know who also worked those tapings was Tyson Dukes, a mainstay of WWE Toronto tapings.
Dark matches, yeah. Okay, are you, look at his entrance.
Okay, I'm at Kidman's entrance. Wow, so Roode got his own entrance?
No. Just the way they introduced him in the
Holy shit. Look at this guy. Oh my god. That fucking cape. What was he thinking? He looks like Simon Dean. Oh, he waves the cape around like he's Tito Santana.
The cape.
Jimmy Corderas is in there.
The cape, the hair.
Oh, dude, is dyed blonde hair like the worst legacy of like the late 90s, early 2000s?
Well, I mean, there are still people who do it, you know? Dolph Ziggler.
They can't be saved at this point.
But I mean, like, it's hard to picture the Bobby Roode we know now with this terrible dye job and the terrible goatee to go along with it. Just, oh my god.
This is something else, folks. Go look it up. Just search Billy Kidman versus Bobby Roode. They actually got like 6 minutes here almost. Oh god, he went to throw him to the steps. But Kidman just went down into the barricade. Very clunky here. Oh, man. He looked just a terrible hair. You know what's become my favorite part of Japanese audio wrestling is W.H. Park and his just rundown of guys' looks. I mean, he is just – he doesn't spare any feelings of a guy just looking like some geek with like – shitty haircuts, shitty tights. It's my favorite part. WH assessing the look of different wrestlers and their gear and grading their gear. It's great.
He's the Joan Rivers of Japanese wrestling.
He really is. I enjoy it. He's just brutally honest with his opinions on Tetsuya Naito and Yoshihashi. It's great stuff. Go catch it. The Joan Rivers of live audio wrestling, WH Park. All right, well, Bobby Roode, who was not signed at this point in time, so not part of the roster. Man, so much to talk about on this show. It started off with The Undertaker in his locker room with his broken hand stemming from an injury angle on SmackDown, wearing a cast. When Kane walks in, they were on opposing shows at this point with some phenomenal creative behind both characters at this juncture. He comes in, sits down next to him, and just looks at The Undertaker. So how was your week? And that's how we kick off the pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
I'm being accused of murder, and you're being accused of cheating on your pregnant wife. Ha!
Yeah.
Essentially admitting these storylines are fucking ridiculous, so we're going to have some fun with them, mm-hmm. which they did, and just wait until what they had in store for you the next night. This was only the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. This is, I remember, during a time where they are really trying to push Kane's personality and having him speak and break out as more of a three-dimensional personality. And I think a big part of that was to try to showcase some of his comedic delivery. And, you know, this was that.
Yep. Sticking his tongue down Terry Runnels' throat. Lots of stuff going on for the Kane character at this point. They had so many ideas for him. And then we go into the opening of the pay-per-view, which featured highlights of Triple H accusing Kane of murdering the infamous Katie Vick.
Now, this was before the, I think the angle that we all remember of, you know, the actual skit in the casket. That was to come.
Yeah, that, the next night.
Mm-hmm. But really, the build-up and I'd say the match that the whole thing culminated to was this, tonight.
And I would imagine that when most people think of Triple H and Kane, they do not remember the fact that this was the elimination of the Intercontinental title, where they were going to unify it with the world title.
Oh, complete afterthought.
And clearly they believed, well, that's not big enough. We need some motivation here for Kane to want to kill Triple H. Did you say kill? Wait a minute. I've got a great idea, guys. How about a death in Kane's past, and we introduce it from a PI Triple H who has uncovered the details of this secret in Kane's history. And that was the main focus of this feud. Not so much the titles and the elimination of the Intercontinental title, which can't say I was too upset at the time they were getting rid of. And now in hindsight, I mean, they brought this title back so quickly. And you look at the status of that title today, kind of could have remained buried, in my opinion.
It could have. I mean, I still see a lot of value in having a secondary title, especially now. You know, like back then you had two world championships. Now you only have one. It really all depends on what you make of it. And they just, you know, back then and now they just haven't really put that much effort into that title.
They cut back and forth between the Triple H Kane match with The Undertaker and Brock Lesnar, who would have their Hell in a Cell match, which this consisted of a voiceover in Latin, presumably reading the last rites, and also having the sound effects of a baby crying to signify Sarah's unborn child, with Paul Heyman doing a voiceover. But this was very much the Paul Heyman, like the delivery he would give when he was promoting like those ECW commercials for a pay-per-view, just reading this delivery. It was very different from the current Paul Heyman delivery, I found.
Yes, you were the Phenom during a decade of destruction. And this is your signature match. One which you have ruled with domination and brutality. But you've never walked through hell with a man as sadistic as Brock. A ruthless animal that has destroyed the greatest icon the world has ever seen. This is the new Phenom that is going to annihilate, lay waste to your legend, destroy all that you hold so dear.
So many
your destiny has arrived. It condemns you to hell.
He speaks the son of dead man.
Rest in peace.
And they had this one shot of the Undertaker screaming in pain with the baby crying over top of it. It was the most ridiculous thing. This might be the most ridiculous Undertaker program of all time. All of this combined with Tracy and his unborn child. This was just something else. This was the Undertaker, I think, being a little too lenient with what creative was throwing at this guy.
Well, I'll say anything involving Sarah in this period of the Undertaker really has not been – was never good.
The Undertaker is not a character that should be associated with sex, ever. I never want to picture the dead man putting his penis into anything. I don't need that visual, and I don't need this reminder that this man has a sex life. He's the one character that should not be even considered human.
Okay. Sure.
Like, come on. Can you honestly, should this character really be associated with a wife or a child or?
No, I think it's, what is it? Like, I feel like, you know, demonic princes are able to have, spouses, you know, maybe multiple spouses.
Well, this was also the most, I guess, human version of the Undertaker. This was still his American badass version.
But, back. I was just more kind of critiquing all the creative surrounding the character and just trying to, you know, force his wife as a character with the angles like this, with, of course, you know, the DDP thing. Just none of it was very good.
No, and that to me was always the biggest difference between the Undertaker and Kane characters. It seemed like the wackiest ideas would be reserved for these supernatural characters, and I think the Undertaker had a great feel for what his character could do and would turn down a lot of stuff. And it always appeared to me that Kane would just be game for anything. And you can look at the history of these two characters and see that difference.
Oh yeah.
So we have, Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler calling the Raw portion and Michael Cole and Taz on SmackDown. 6 title matches out of the 8 matches here. And we kick things off with Chris Jericho and Christian, the World Tag Team Champions, not to be confused with the WWE Tag Team Champions, which would be new titles introduced on this show. Jericho and Christian defending the titles against Booker T and Goldust. And we had separate entrances here for all 4 guys. This took about 20 minutes. Jericho came out and was announced as not one half, but the World Tag Team Champion. And this match eventually began. The Jericho and Booker were essentially feuding over Booker referring to him as a sucker, and Jericho taking umbrage with this term and going back and forth with sneak attacks on one another.
Yeah. You know, I think seeing the match, seeing this match and thinking about, you know, what SmackDown had to offer in terms of their tag team division at the time just kind of really reminded me just how much, how lacking the Raw crew was, at least creatively, at this time.
That was one of the interviews I always remember most was Chris Jericho when he was originally drafted to SmackDown and all the talent that was there. And then he got moved to Raw and he did some interviews saying, going from SmackDown to Raw, it feels like going from the Detroit Red Wings, who had just won the Stanley Cup, to the Nashville Predators, which in 2002 was not a compliment to Raw. Jericho won't start off with Booker, so Christian begins. We saw Christian catapult Jericho over the top to Christian on the floor. They eventually got the heat on Goldust. Crowd was chanting for Booker. Goldust cut off Jericho with a clothesline. We saw Goldust come in, hit a double facebuster eventually, the Golden Globes to Christian, then does a drop toe hold, sending Jericho into the balls of Christian, and then a schoolboy for a two count. And then Jericho counters the curtain call, gets the walls of Jericho, but Booker breaks it up, and then Booker misses a drop kick. Does the spin-a-rooney. Jericho gets tossed to the floor, and then Jericho goes for a drop kick off the second rope that he usually does to the guy on the apron. But as he sprung off the second rope, the rope snapped, and Jericho just tumbled down. This was a total clusterfuck here.
It could have been really bad. Imagine if he went for his finish.
Oh, if he had been going for the lion salt, this could have been absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
For those that might recall, it was Hayabusa who actually paralyzed himself going for that same quebrada, and the rope didn't break, but he came off and landed on his head, and that's what I immediately thought of watching this. And he was just so lucky he had because the quebrada, the lion salt, was totally going to be the finish because you could see the way they just improvised here, and then Jericho called the audible and went for a moonsault off the top rope, which would not be the audible I would be calling after I just saw a rope snap and could be calling into question the rope being placed up here, and gets the pinfall on Goldust at 8:47, and I guess a worse scenario was at least averted here. But man, this was nuts. You don't typically see this kind of a mess up on a WWE show. But this was, thankfully, no one hurt too badly.
Yeah, I would have been pissed, you know, if something like this had happened. And
rightfully so.
Yeah, but I thought just a great improvisation on Jericho's part to not even really skip a beat and just go for that full picture-perfect moonsault to substitute for the finish. And really impressive, you know, how good it looked considering he rarely does it. So I think great for him. I also have to comment about how, you know, Goldust here, what, 12 years earlier? I feel like he's a better worker now than he was back then. You know, size-wise, I imagine he's probably similar in size, but, like, he looks much faster, much more smoother now than he did back then.
I agree. We need to one day take a look at his Black Reign era, the low point of Dustin Rhodes. Funaki is in the back, the confidant of one Hideo Itami in NXT, back here during his role as the SmackDown backstage announcer, and he's got a big scoop with Al Wilson, a one-on-one interview with Al Wilson. And this brought back some wonderful memories. And he showed all this footage to Al of Dawn Marie hitting on him, including showing off a bikini to Al before a lingerie contest. Funaki asking him, how did this peak make you feel? As Al, just the most awkward human being to ever grace a WWE broadcast, with just mumbling his answers. Then Dawn giving a key to her hotel room. And then the climax of this, probably a literal climax for Al Wilson. In a shower, clothed with Dawn Marie, and Funaki asking the question that we all had.
Why were you wearing your clothes in the shower?
I'm going to say this once only. I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
I guess being in Arkansas, their reference to Bill Clinton.
Uh-huh.
The start of some phenomenal backstage vignettes tonight, Wei.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I commented about how the creative on SmackDown was much better than Raw. I guess I'm selectively blocking out a lot of the parts of SmackDown that I thought were pretty bad too at the time, and this was certainly one of them. It was kind of a, you know, it was embarrassing to watch this.
Never have I recalled a show where I've seen the absolute best and absolute worst of a specific brand, as we did SmackDown. I mean, 2002, the fall of 02, for perhaps for many, the highest point of SmackDown in terms of how well it's remembered. But I think a lot of this stuff, conveniently forgotten, which would, of course, lead to the death of Al Wilson.
Yes. And this segment went on forever. Like, I mean,
this was really long and a really lame punchline to the end
so
of it.
So lame. I mean, not even creative.
And not even timely in 2002. Not even close to time. We were already on to another administration at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we had Dawn Marie and Tori Wilson, and they're explaining to us Al Wilson was recently divorced, so single and looking to mingle. Dawn gets sent off the apron and starts stomping Tori on the floor, driving Tori's back into the apron and then worked over the back. And Dawn Marie then delivered a headbutt to the abdomen of Tori Wilson, and Taz explaining that this probably does not hurt Tori, as apparently Taz believed she was targeting the crotch area. And then Michael Cole stating he would know if that hurt or not. Bizarre commentary here. Mm-hmm. They had a cat fight spot rolling over referee Mike Sparks, who got very excited by this. And Dawn then hits something that resembled like a forearm to Tori's throat, and Cole proclaiming, "What a clothesline!" And then Taz, with maybe the creepiest line of the entire night, stating, "I wish my mother looked like that," in reference to Dawn Marie. Tori then sends her into the turnbuckle, gets a schoolgirl for a two, then drops Dawn on the top rope and hits a swinging neckbreaker and pins Dawn Marie at 440, and then screams, "That was for my dad! That was for my dad." Mm-hmm. I will say this. Having watched so many of the current Divas matches right now of the Rosa Mendez variety and such, I probably in 2002 detested this match, and this match was absolutely passable by today's standards, I thought.
I agree. I thought these, you know, my expectations going into this, especially for Tori and Dawn, who really aren't known as, you know, the workers of the bunch of the division
not
at this
all.
Time, I thought they delivered above expectations. It was definitely far from perfect, but I thought their transitions and their pacing were pretty good. They worked a faster match than I'm used to seeing with a lot of the girls these days.
Yeah, this was really when you were starting to see the Fit Finley influence come in, and I know Lance Storm worked a lot with the women, and I think 2003, you really saw the culmination, and not to say Tori and Dawn were really part of that, but this was a passable match and exceeded my expectations in hindsight from this. They had a Survivor Series promo. This was interesting. I watched this. I did not watch this on network. But I know on the network, they've taken out all of these ads promoting the next pay-per-view. And I don't know why they went to that length to take out, you know, what's the worst that can happen? Someone watches the next pay-per-view? It was just plugging, hey, our next pay-per-view is coming up in 4 weeks at Madison Square Garden. And they went to the trouble of eliminating these promos from the network version.
I wonder if there's a reason. Like, don't they do that for all the DVD releases?
You know why they might have? Because that Saliva song was underneath this, and maybe that was the reason they took it out, because maybe. They probably don't have the maybe the rights to play a Saliva song.
But I'm sure like when they package pay-per-views, DVD releases and, you know, any type of future thing, they clean it up and take out anything. Like, because there are parts of these broadcasts on the network that you notice they cut out some VOs here and there, where there's just like a long break in silence. So I wonder if that was just part of it.
We had a pair of great Jonathan Coachman interviews in the back. The first was with Rob Van Dam, who's scheduled to take on Ric Flair. The prior month, Ric Flair had turned heel and assisting Triple H to retain the title over Van Dam at Unforgiven. So now these two are going to have a match. Van Dam went over all of Flair's usual catchphrases, and RVD states that he doesn't style, he doesn't profile, he doesn't need limos, and often he can be seen in the line waiting at Hertz to drive to the next town, and often gets stuck in coach in the middle seat, and he's a chair-smashing, frog-splashing, risk-taking, yinning and yanging, van-daminating dude as he starts strutting around. If ever there was a promo that did not match the performer, this would be maybe my number one pick.
Yeah.
This was the most goofiest Rob Van Dam promo I've ever watched. It was like painful to watch this man who probably spent the entire day memorizing this as opposed to going over his match with Ric Flair.
Yeah, exactly my thoughts. I mean, I understand. I'm sure, you know, it was part of Rob Van Dam's own frustrations that he wasn't really getting a chance to speak on the mic very much. And I get that they wanted to have him say something more than, you know, whatever, dude. But this promo, the way it was written for him, it was just really awkward for his personality. Not something you'd ever get the impression that this guy would come up with on his own. And he certainly didn't have the delivery to match it.
And you have to imagine for Van Damme at this time period, when you're watching so much of the Heyman influence over on SmackDown, and here he was on Raw as a character that he will admit, I think, the entire writing staff, they never understood this character and passed, you know, the in-ring portion that people got into, and they just had this, this was the end result of doing stuff like this with Rob Van Dam, where he really just kind of floated around on Raw after that great introduction in 2001, where he felt like a guy that was going to be a huge star at the time. At least that's how the crowd took to him. And by this point in time, you were seeing where he was kind of going to settle in the middle of the card. Then Coachman, some late breaking, another scoop here to Top Funaki. He sees Brock and Heyman walking into the arena along with Tracy. This was our introduction to Tracy on this show. Heyman and Lesnar will not speak to Coachman, and Coachman gets an exclusive with Tracy, who has accused The Undertaker of having an affair with her and calls Undertaker a scumbag. And after this promo, JR refers to her as a Jezebel.
No, there is no accusations. What I said was the truth. He is a liar and a cheat. Everything that I have said is the truth. I am here tonight to watch that scumbag get what he deserves inside Hell in a Cell.
Tracy.
Ouch.
We'd see a lot of Tracy on this show.
I don't remember this girl at all.
No, nor did I. I vaguely remembered it watching this pay-per-view, but had completely extinguished this from my memory, the Tracy storyline, which I think really got a pass during the Katie Vick era yeah. of this company during the month of October. Ric Flair and Rob Van Dam was next. Ric Flair, I got to say, pretty jacked up for 53 years of age at this time.
I'll say, yeah. I mean, doesn't really look like many 53-year-olds that I know.
Dare I say he's a nominee?
Sure.
Might be the oldest nominee. No, Vince McMahon would probably be the biggest nominee we've ever... The oldest nominee, right. I mean. There was a lot of Scott Putski in the world of wrestling over the last week, way.
That's right. Yeah, well, what else aside from the Monday Night Wars?
Well, that's it.
Oh.
Okay. He was brought up by CM Punk, and Punk taking into question if Scott Putski was a legitimate light heavyweight, as they showed footage of Scott Putski on this episode of the Monday Night War, where this is the most ridiculous looking man to ever enter pro wrestling. I mean, yes, you have your Rob Terrys, and I mean, there's some dudes that look nuts, but Scott Putski was just like an inflatable blimp of a man that was just didn't even look human. I mean, I don't know how this man walked to the ring without tearing something in his body. An unbelievable specimen. I will never, ever look at Scott Putski and understand how this man happened. Van Dam storms Ric Flair and attacks him on the floor before the bell rings, hits a twisting leg drop off the apron as Flair is draped on the apron. Flair hits a low blow out of the corner that Nick Patrick misses and then clips the left knee of Van Dam. And Flair just doing all his usual heel tactics, a thumb to the eye, working over the knee. Lawler starts discussing Tracy, and just out of nowhere, asks Jim Ross if pregnant women are attractive. It seemed like Jerry Lawler was just, he loved these fucking storylines and just asking Jim Ross all these questions revolving these storylines that you knew Jim Ross probably just rolled his eyes at.
And then Jim Ross comes back and says something like, of course they are.
I love this because, you know, he was here coming to the defense of women, and then he would make a statement later.
Oh, yeah.
On in the show that was just so offensive. Flair gets a figure four. Van Damme fights and rolls over to the ropes. Crowd seem more into Flair here than they did Van Damme. Goes for another figure four. There's a roll up for a two count. Then tosses Flair off the top, the usual Flair bump. Hits the rolling thunder, but Flair gets his foot on the rope. And then Van Damme hops to the top, hits the frog splash, but then grabs his knee and then reverts to pinning Flair and gets the win in 8 minutes.
I thought it was a good match for, you know, a 53-year-old Ric Flair. You had a sort of a styles clash here between the two. Van Damme with his high flying and Flair, very grounded with the, you know, more of his chopping, a lot of chops. But overall, I thought the match was decent.
Big shows with Stephanie in the back. And he's, of course, Stephanie being the general manager of SmackDown at the time and Big Show being a Raw talent. He's complaining about something not being fair when Eric Bischoff storms in, telling him he is Raw property. And Stephanie refers to Big Show as Paul and leaves the two alone. And Big Show starts complaining about his spot, says he hasn't been on a pay-per-view since July and hasn't headlined and he doesn't know how long. And he starts listing off his credentials. And meanwhile, he's standing around here with his thumb up his ass and says how he's not allowed to talk to Stephanie. Bischoff tells him this. And then Big Show grabs Bischoff, throws him against these crates, and states he should be a main eventer and threatens to break the neck of one Eric Bischoff. And this was a result of the WWE having to change their plans around for the Survivor Series because the plan was to have Lesnar and Hulk Hogan headline that show. And they wanted Lesnar, of course, to beat Hogan again. And Hogan wasn't going for that, brother. So Hogan was not coming back and they suddenly had to make a new top guy. And Big Show was their decision. And this was the start of that 4 week build, which would surprisingly, stunning at the time, lead to Big Show beating Brock Lesnar for the title the very next month at the Survivor Series.
Mm-hmm.
What a kickoff. Then we got this video on the history of the Intercontinental title with quite the musical track here. Just, what a look back here at the Intercontinental title and what it once was. All these highlights of past champions and controversial moments they had with Austin injuring his neck. And we got some of the less memorable champions, including Rikishi, Billy Gunn, The Godfather, and Val Venus, all winning this title.
They also made the WrestleMania 6 main event look like it was only for the IC Championship.
Well, yes, it was, I guess that would have been their last title versus title match, the top title against the Intercontinental title, Hogan and Warrior.
Mm.
Here we are.
But, you know, I thought it was really well done video, and I almost felt like this should have been enough to promote a match like this without any of the Katie Vick stuff.
Come on, Wei, who's going to give a shit about a title? You need a rap sheet. You need a conspiracy. You need a cover-up.
Yeah.
That's what you need for your title picture. Out came current stooge, I guess, Jamie Noble, then the Cruiserweight Champion, accompanied by Nydia, taking on Tajiri, two men that have been on national television over the past month between WWE and TNA. No Nydia, though, to speak of. This was brought up after a boyfriend versus girlfriend match on SmackDown, where Noble and Nydia had a match with Tajiri as the referee, and somehow led to this match, and they had been doing a storyline where Jamie Noble would allow Tajiri to have turns with his girlfriend, I guess.
Yeah.
That was the storyline.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they had come to a heated confrontation here at No Mercy. So the match begins with a baseball slide and an acai moonsault delivered by Tajiri to Noble before the bell even rings. Noble hit this running electric chair out of the corner that looked really cool. And then was working over the back of Tajiri and kind of followed the theme of a lot of these matches where they just isolated body parts and worked them over, the heels did. Taz, much like the most recent Tajiri run, noted he's been in the ring many times with Tajiri, but didn't bury him in this particular outing. There were these back elbows from Tajiri out of the corner, missed a moonsault, but then hit a tornado DDT, hit a handspring back elbow. Tarantula gets applied, and Michael Cole notes that the tarantula is now a legal hold, yet this didn't explain why the referee was counting to five and then forcing the break.
I feel like he was trying to say illegal, but I thought he said legal too.
Oh, okay. Well, either way, I don't know if the tarantula was ever a hold that could not result in a disqualification if you didn't release it. I mean, you're in the ropes.
Mm-hmm.
You should have asked Jimmy Corderas for some clarification here. Noble ducks a head kick, then is catapulted into the ring, hits a head kick as Nydia then starts making out with Brian Hebner to distract him. There's a tiger bomb by Tajiri to Tajiri, who kicks out. Then Tajiri goes for a victory roll. It's blocked as Nydia holds on to Noble's leg, giving him the leverage to land on top and pins him at 8 minutes, 15 seconds. So Noble retains the title. And then afterwards, Tajiri grabs Nydia, kisses her, and she intimates that she enjoys this, and then Noble kisses Nydia, and then Tajiri kicks Noble in the head while he's kissing Nydia and laying both of them out.
Right. Yeah.
That was that.
Yeah, that was that. I mean, I thought it was a good match. Impressive.
Very different from the cruiserweight style. I mean, this was very much the WWE version where the cruiserweights were essentially put out there to work the same style as everybody else. They weren't doing a drastically different cruiserweight style that you would see in WCW.
No, but I thought, you know, maybe a little faster than you know, obviously you'd get from a lot of the heavyweights. I don't know. I think at the time, a lot of this, I just found this, all the Nydia, Jamie Noble, and Tajiri stuff. I just found that it all kind of gross.
Well, Nydia was, you know, very, I guess, wasn't too monogamous at the time, and neither was Jamie Noble.
Oh, that's fine. Nothing wrong with that. I just, I don't know. It just never, like, equated to interesting wrestling storyline to me, you know? It just gave him some identity, sure, but, anyway, I don't know.
Not impressed with Nydia and Jamie Noble in 2002. Then we go backstage, and Chris Benoit is searching for Eddie Guerrero and finds him in the back and informs Eddie, hey, Kurt's beating the shit out of your nephew right now, and takes him to this room where he hears Chavo screaming in the room, but then Eddie starts laughing and thinking this is a setup, and was hilarious in his description here, stating, that's not Chavo, that's a little girl. And then the door opens and Chavo is thrown out of this room by Kurt as Benoit smiles and Angle laughs as Chavo has been beaten up in front of Eddie.
I always get a kick out of like seeing Eddie Guerrero perform in these backstage vignettes just because it just feels like a guy who's just having a lot of fun with it, especially when he's a heel. You know, it feels like you and your buddies taking a camera and like filming a stupid play when you're drunk. And that's how it always feels whenever he like, you know, performs as like this kind of cocky heel character who I don't know, screws up. I think it's very funny.
The next time, Wei, you think you're getting duped by someone, I want you to take your finger and start moving it up and down your lips to call bullshit on this ploy by somebody.
What do you mean?
The way Eddie did it, where he starts, I don't even know what to call it, where he took his finger and he's just like moving it up and down his lips. Did you see this part?
Okay, yeah.
It's so goofy. I laughed out loud at this whole deal. This might have been one of the best backstage segments ever involving Chris Benoit.
Yeah, maybe.
They did this deal a little later on where I remember this promo so well, where Eddie walks in and he thinks Chris is mad at him. And Eddie goes through all these different emotions from thinking they're friends to just getting furious. And it's like 3 minutes of Benoit just standing there stone-faced as Eddie Guerrero does all of the talking and goes through all these different emotions and then walks out. And I remember at the time thinking, this is the best Benoit promo I've ever seen. He didn't even say a word. Well, he just stood there.
I mean, they're probably using each other to their strengths. And Benoit's strength was probably just, you know, standing there expressionless. And you could make that work.
Then they cut to Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, who tee up the next match being built on mind games.
Oh, and then, those types of mind games?
These were different mind games, unless they were thinking of going even further with Triple H and Kane. Jerry Lawler then says he would never want to be in the ring with a murderer. As we go into this video package, Triple H against Kane. And what a package this was. I mean, we just saw a roller coaster for Kane's life here.
Kane, you said,
for the first time in my life, I'm happy.
Let me ask you a question, Kane. How happy is Katie Vick?
Katie Vick was a friend of mine.
10 years ago?
It was an accident.
You killed her.
I didn't kill her.
You are a murderer.
We went to a party and Katie had too much to drink, so I decided that I should drive her home.
You were drinking too, Kane.
It was dark, road was slick, and an animal jumped right out in front of us.
There were empty beer cans in the car.
Katie was killed instantly.
But it was an accident. You killed Katie Vick.
I'm sorry.
Kane might be able to take the life of a sweet girl like Katie Vick, but he will never be able to take my title.
Pronouncing to the world that for the first time in his life, he's happy. And Triple H then coming out and revealing the Katie Vick death and asking how happy she was when she was killed 10 years ago. And they decided to go even further with a reenactment of the car accident, where we got footage of this, and the explanation by Kane that an animal had ran out into the middle of the highway, and then we got shots of a graveyard. They're bringing up that alcohol may have been involved because they had left a party, which was followed by Kane just saying, I'm sorry, after this accusation that he may have been drinking and driving, resulting in someone's death. How this was to get sympathy on Kane. I mean, this was left very ambiguous at the time that Kane very well could have been at fault here.
Should have been arrested.
Should have absolutely been arrested. How this all played into the Kane storyline that he'd been burned as a child and kept in captivity by Paul Bearer. That was all glossed over.
Is any of this explained in that book?
I've never read that book.
Oh, okay.
You know who we need to have on here?
Michael Chiappetta.
He could break it all down for us. The saga of Glenn Jacobs and Mark Calloway and how the Katie Vick storyline
is
plausible.
Katie Vick is mentioned in the book, isn't she?
God, I really want to read this book now. You know, I got it. I remember they sent the book to me and I immediately just gave it away. And what a bad idea.
Journey into Darkness?
Journey into Darkness.
Yeah, I want to read it too.
It sounds like some book that would be on your like English syllabus, like this Journey into Darkness, and then you actually get the book and it's anything but a classic. So that sets up Triple H and Kane, the battle of good and evil, Motorhead versus Finger 11. Jerry Lawler is just disgusted over the fact that this murderer is going to be wrestling and how you can never trust a murderer, to which Jim Ross defends this, saying that an animal ran out in front of him, and Lawler saying it's worth it to hit small animals.
Okay.
It's not very kind. Kane, pardon the pun, gets the heat early on.
I'm just reading the Wikipedia for this Journey into Darkness.
Do share the plot.
It's just weird, first of all, seeing Michael Chiappetta's name on the cover of this book. Respected MMA journalist, Michael Chiappetta, the author of this. And then here's a bit of the synopsis. The Callaway name, which runs contrary to the spelling of Mark Callaway, as established by the caption to a high school yearbook photograph and his father's obituary, the altercation of the Undertaker's real-life last name in the book is therefore understandable as a real-life history, which involves both Kane and the Undertaker, as well as Paul Bearer. In addition, Glenn Jacobs' name has been spelled incorrectly in some sources as Glenn, possibly because of this. Jacobs also had the S dropped to simply become Jacob, which makes sense for a middle name. Kane spent time over in Spain learning his craft.
I was never aware of this in his trip to Spain.
It also goes on to state that Kane is the victim of a rare disorder called hereditary sensory and autonomic neuropathy. This meant that Kane was incapable of feeling pain, but could still feel other sensations through touch. It also attempts to explain how Katie Vick came into contact with Kane, a massive continuity gaffe at the time she was introduced. Loose ends. The story deals with the story deals very little with some of the much larger components of Kane, such as how and when he gained supernatural abilities similar to the Undertaker's. It also does not explain where the Undertaker gained his abilities. It does claim that Kane has a condition called hereditary sensory and autonomous neuropathy, which, although it does not remove the ability to feel tactile sensation, renders Kane incapable of feeling pain unless it is in great amounts. As an attempt to explain why Kane seemingly feels no physical pain in the early days of his career, unless he sustains large amounts of punishment during matches. This creates a plot hole that it does not explain why the Undertaker seems to... I can't believe, like, grown men have attempted to explain this. Oh, man. I really want to read this book.
Yeah, and the people who have never attempted to explain it are the ones that have created and maintained this character for 17 years. I can guarantee you no one on the creative end has probably ever sat down and asked how any of this stuff makes sense
just,
with this
can
guy.
You just imagine like somebody given the task of, you know, weaving through this very complicated, poorly put together storyline and trying to tie everything back.
Oh, jeez. Boy. Well, despite not being able to feel pain unless in large amounts, Kane has not been too successful given that incredible leg up on so many of his opposition over the years. This match would be evidence of that. I wrote more quotes here from Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler than I did parts of the match. Early on, Jerry Lawler is just making jokes about Katie Vick, and Jim Ross goes to say... Just think of this. Think of this if this was like a real life murder case involving a woman dying. Jim Ross states, if Katie Vick's family is watching tonight, I apologize. In what world would the Vick estate be ordering tonight's pay-per-view offering where the man that murdered their daughter is going after his world championship and they're sitting down to watch this pay-per-view where their daughter's murder is going to be on full display tonight and told to the hundreds of thousands of pay-per-view buyers. I love this visual of Katie Vick's family being WWF fans through all these hardships that this man has put their lives through. Hunter sends him to the floor, and this running knee sends Kane into the post and gains the advantage in the ring. Ross is joking about parts of Jerry Lawler's past that he probably doesn't want to be brought up, including running for mayor, which he would do again after this pay-per-view. Very slow match, I thought. The commentary is mainly focusing on Katie Vick. Jim Ross cuts off Lawler at one point and says,
"Between Katie Vick and Seaman, I'm having a hell of a time focusing on this winner-take-all match, thanks to you."
A great JR line. Huh. Ric Flair runs in. He shoves referee Earl Hebner and then snaps the arm of Kane over the top rope. Kane is then he takes down both in the ring, but then Hunter hits him with a belt shot as the referee just plays dumb here. Kane kicks out of two. Then the Hurricane, who was teaming with Kane at the time, runs down to attack Flair, but then runs into Hunter, who kills him with a pedigree. That would be the last we'd see of Hurricane as he would go through the crowd with Flair. Kane sits up, fires up on Hunter. Hunter knocks him off the top. They
went through all these spots. Hunter blocked a choke slam, a big boot misses. Kane then catches Hunter off the apron, choke slams him through the announce table, and then is no-selling these Flair chops, which then he brings Hunter into the ring, stops Flair with a sledgehammer, and grabs the sledgehammer, and Lawler proclaims, "This is the only thing worse than Kane being behind the wheel of a car." There's a low blow to Kane. He lifts him up for the tombstone. He's hit with the sledgehammer in midair. Then Kane chokeslams him, recovering from the sledgehammer shot. A second ref runs in, gets pulled out by Flair, gets decked on the floor. Kane then chokeslams Flair in the ring. Hunter knocks him into the corner, hits the pedigree for the win. The pedigree outdoes the sledgehammer shots, and Triple H prevails over Kane in 16 and a half minutes, and he is your unified champion. And the Intercontinental title would disappear for about the time a wrestler would go after a retirement match. A couple of months.
The match definitely started off pretty slow, but I'll say, you know, the crowd was hot for this thing. Despite the stupid storyline, they're reacting pretty strong to this feud. And I think largely because Kane was actually a legitimately over character at the time.
They definitely believed he could win this match, which is something.
Yeah, and Hunter was certainly, you know, a hated heel. And Ric Flair, I just thought was great. I thought he was very entertaining playing the pest outside the ring. You know, strong reactions from the audience throughout the last 5 minutes of this, but, otherwise, you know, a decent match.
It was fine. I mean, at this point in time, Hunter really didn't have a whole lot of guys to work with on Raw that were, I mean, you were comparing them to SmackDown, obviously, where the talent was very much on one side of the fence at this point in time when it came to top talent. And, you know, a lot of shortcuts in this match, but as you said, the crowd was certainly into this match. It was a very, they didn't sell out this arena, but the crowd that was there, they were very hot throughout this show. Oh, and then we go to Stephanie in her office and in walks Tracy. And I just knew this was going to be something. I didn't remember this segment, but boy, what a treat going down memory lane. As Stephanie says, "Woman to woman, I understand about relationships. I was just watching my ex-husband." And Tracy says she doesn't love The Undertaker or the ground that that bastard walks on, but then informs Stephanie that she received a call from Paul Heyman, who was all familiar with Tracy and The Undertaker's past relationship. And this was some of the most horrendous exposition you will ever see in a wrestling environment, where it was just painful explanation of this storyline, where Stephanie like a fishing rod just reels in tidbit after tidbit, where the storyline is essentially that Tracy and The Undertaker had a relationship 7 years ago prior to The Undertaker ever meeting Sarah, but then, as Tracy says, confidentially, between just you and I, Steph, she wants Mark back. And in fact, she didn't sleep with him in the last 10 days or have an affair. I just want Mark back. And then, like something out of a fucking horror movie, we just pan to the left, and there is The Undertaker standing there in this very room where they were having a confidential one-on-one discussion, and calls Tracy a lying bitch. And Tracy is kicked out of the arena and theoretically kicked out of this storyline forever as we wrap up the Tracy storyline. And she was just a liar this whole time.
Yeah. What a terrible actress, first of all, this Tracy. What terrible writing. A storyline that just did nothing to serve this match. It was just brought up and then completely dismissed, you know, very quickly rushed wrap up just in a little segment like this. And I wondered why I didn't remember it.
This was like verbatim what we saw earlier this year with Daniel Bryan and the physical therapist.
I've already forgotten about that.
Well, as have they, and as have we about Tracy here. It was at a time point where, like 2002, you had a lot of great talent, but man, it was like the hangover effect from the Attitude Era, where the idea of doing a Hell in a Cell match or a title unification, it's like that just wasn't enough. We had to do these fucking personal, like, vendetta issues that just added nothing
just watered these stories down to me. And then we had to have stuff like this where it was just, okay, how do we write this storyline out and just completely forget about it? And you'd never hear of this Tracy woman again.
Yeah.
Then, just the complete contrast to that segment, we got a video highlighting the tag tournament that was introduced on SmackDown to create new tag champions and the storyline that Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit would have to team up, and if either of their differences led to them losing a match, they would be suspended for a year without pay.
Okay.
Wow.
That's a little over the top.
Heavy stakes. If you guys argue and you lose a match as a result of this not getting along, a year without pay.
Was that the stip? If they lost the match and they would be suspended?
Yeah.
It's not fair.
What they explained here. Now, we look back at this time and everyone talks about, you know, this tag division that SmackDown had. But my goodness, you remember the great teams. But I think there's a lot of teams we forget about, which we got to see when they showed the brackets for this SmackDown tournament. Teams such as D-Von and Ron Simmons, John Cena and Billy Kidman, Mark Henry and Rikishi, and the one-time team that I just so badly want to go back and watch, Brock Lesnar and Tajiri teaming up to go after these tag titles.
No, that couldn't have been an actual thing. I'm pretty sure I don't even recall that match happening. I'm pretty sure it was just probably,
it's part of the brackets. The match had to have happened. Maybe Brock just walked out on him.
Yeah, they must have done that. Because Brock was the champion at that time.
He was. Doesn't mean he couldn't go for the tag titles. Here we are. Brock Lesnar and Tajiri versus Rey Mysterio and Edge, October 10th, 2002.
Yeah. Okay.
13 minutes.
And the match actually takes place?
It took place on SmackDown. It was the opening match of the tournament.
Oh, wow.
I'm imagining Tajiri took the fall in that one. This was interesting. We had Benoit and Angle against Edge and Rey Mysterio. Two of these three guys would all have like major neck surgeries within the span of about 2 years, with Benoit, Edge, and Angle, and of course Rey Mysterio, not exactly the glowing sign of perfect health. Just to put into context what some of these matches had in terms of impact on these guys' careers. We had Jimmy Corderas as the referee here. Edge coming out to his Rob Zombie theme of Never Gonna Stop.
Okay.
What a memorable tune. This was a good match. This is a very good match, Way.
It was excellent. Go
22
ahead.
Minutes these guys went. I don't even know where to start here, but, it started off very slow, just working off of the Angle Rey Mysterio feud and kind of Angle fucking around with Rey, and then Edge eventually coming in. They would get the heat on Edge, and it just started building and building. As we went into what was basically like a 10-minute finishing sequence where it was just spot after spot after spot, way too many to go through here. But we saw Edge, some of the highlights here, Edge sending Rey up into a Frankensteiner to Angle off the top, Benoit then coming off the top to break the cover with a headbutt. Edge got this awesome near fall as a result of that. Rey then running at Edge and then being overhead suplexed into Angle by Edge. Edge then setting up for a spear, and Benoit comes from behind, gets the crossface. It's broken by a 619. Angle slam to Rey, and then Angle and Edge go back and forth with ankle locks, and it ends with Angle countering back into the ankle lock and getting the pin or the submission at 22 minutes and 4 seconds. I just thought this was phenomenal. It got the Observer's Match of the Year award that year, and I remember watching this at the time just being blown away by this tag match.
I remember there being a lot of matches that probably made you feel that way, you know, from this whole series between the, you know, what we now call the SmackDown Six. I'm sure this match was just one of, you know, a number of candidates that, you know, this whole bunch had, at the time. But this was just, it was excellent. I mean, so many great sequences and counters crammed into the finish here. Like you said, that lasted, you know, for a long, long time. And I, I really like the pairing of the teams too. I mean, obviously the Guerreros made perfect sense. Benoit and Angle to an extent too, because, you know, these two, they're really just an internet smart marks wet dream, the two people together. But Rey and Edge, I thought, two guys whose styles you wouldn't really consider meshing well together, they ended up being fantastic, as a pair. And I'm sure, you know, this group of guys being paired with each other really allowed them to have the freedom to be completely creative with their abilities. And that's how you get little spots here. Like, you know, Benoit putting Edge in the crossface near the ropes, and then Rey coming in with a 619, managing to hit Benoit, but avoiding Edge like a centimeter away. You know, like little precise things that I'm sure you wouldn't be able to accomplish if it was just anybody else on the roster they're working with.
Yeah, just these four, it was just everything seemed so fluid. I mean, there was nothing botched in this. Everything just flowed so well right through the finish. I thought Michael Cole and Taz were excellent. Their call was tremendous, I thought, throughout this. Really put a ton of heat on these tag titles, really made them feel like a big deal coming out of this tournament. And I think maybe the high point of this whole tag division at this point in 2002. I remember the following month, I mean, expectations were so high because you added the Guerreros into this mix with a three-way, and I thought it somewhat kind of didn't reach everyone's expectations coming off of this match, where I think people, the expectations were just huge at that point. But phenomenal match, easily the best match of this show, and for many people, the best match of 2002. So this was great.
It was a pretty good year from what I recall, with a bunch of candidates.
It was.
Yeah.
So we go backstage for one of the most surreal segments, I would say, ever on a WWE pay-per-view. The Undertaker, with his cast on, is being checked on by the trainer, who's holding a needle and informs the Undertaker that this is not ethical. What am I watching? And Taker responds that without that shot, he's not going to make it through Hell in a Cell. So either he can shoot him up with painkillers, or he's going to take that needle and do it himself. And the trainer, this man who has taken an oath, shoots up the Undertaker with painkillers, presumably without a prescription, and sends the Undertaker into battle.
This is unethical. I'm not supposed to be giving you anything like this.
Yeah, I understand that, Larry. But let me explain something to you. Without that shot, I ain't gonna make it through Hell in a Cell, man. So either you give me the shot, or I'm gonna take that needle and I'm gonna give it to myself. Come on, man.
Not only unethical way, but from just a storyline perspective, when the hand was going to be like the critical part worked over in the match, why would you introduce a story where he can't feel pain in this hand? This didn't even make sense to be airing this other than to like shock people, and not a good kind of shock, like a really kind of fucked up kind of shock.
I mean, I think the idea was to show just how messed up his arm was. And you would assume that even with a shot like that, his hand would still be vulnerable. But simply because of the political ramifications of a scene like this, I mean, there's no way they'd ever do something like this again. But even for 2002, I thought it was kind of mind boggling. And a little shocking to see them film this. Like, this is one of those skits that someday somebody's going to do a documentary, you know, about the drug problem in the WWE. And then somehow they'll acquire footage like this and use this specific scene of the Undertaker being shot up with a needle saying, I need this doc to get through this match. And then we're going to see it and we're going to be like, what the fuck? They filmed this? They filmed this themselves? So I couldn't believe this when I saw it.
Seems like this was just a period of the Undertaker's career where he was just signing off on anything they proposed at him. All right, you shoot me up with a needle on television? Let's do it.
Yeah. I mean, not to mention, you know, this is right after
he had just been cleared of cheating on his pregnant wife moments ago. So he's he had a lot going on at the time in one night.
I guess so. He's got to provide for that new baby. We also this did remind me of, remember that famous scene in Wrestling Reality?
Oh yes.
Do you recall this with Peter Smith?
Yeah, a lot of people, most people will not know what Wrestling Reality is. You should probably explain.
Wrestling Reality was a reality show, shocking, involving a number of wrestlers in Atlantic Canada, and it premiered on the Fight Network a number of years back, involving, Gary Williams, who you might be familiar with, Mike Hughes, Brody Steele, whose real name is Peter Smith, just a lot of, Bobby Roode was also part of, kind of that crew as well.
And he wasn't on the show though.
No, he wasn't on the show. He was already in TNA at this point in time, but it started off, I believe it was back in 2007, and the first season aired on the Fight Network, and it featured this scene that there was a lot of debate at our office of whether we could air this or not, of Peter Smith injecting a needle and taking steroids right on camera and being, can we actually legally show this? I mean, this is an illegal action that this man is committing on camera, and I can't even remember if we aired it as is or not.
Yeah.
I remember watching the uncensored version.
No, for sure we aired it.
Okay, well, there's your answer. So that was there's pro wrestling for you,
mm-hmm.
I guess. There was a – I remember hearing from especially one pro wrestler that used to be in WWE contacting me, just disgusted that we were airing this series and glorifying this kind of thing. But that's – I'm sure it exists online. I'm sure you can find this show. It was an interesting look at pro wrestling, especially at the lower level. Captivating characters.
Yeah, I believe they continued for a second season under a different name outside of the Fight Network, I believe.
Yeah, they did. I can't remember the name that's season two, but they did get a second season. Did not air on Fight Network. All right, so then we go into Victoria and Trish Stratus, with Trish defending the women's title. And JR describing Victoria.
Introducing the challenger, Victoria!
I think this woman right here is chronically pre-menstrual. She is taller than the other side of the pillow, big and strong and powerful, and she is so hungry, King. It's Victoria to become the women's champion here tonight.
Let me ask you something, JR. Are you a sexist? Broads hate that, you know. Pre-menstrual? What kind of statement is that?
She's always in a bad mood.
Yeah, what was this? What was this like?
And a hello to our female audience out there.
And it was Jerry Lawler, of all people, who calls him out on it.
Lawler asks if he's sexist for making a statement like that. Jerry Lawler asking another human being if that's a sexist comment to be making.
Yeah.
That's when you've kind of realized you've gone a little out of line at that point.
Yeah, what a line.
We got a bunch of puppies chants at the start of this match, which was one of the battles a lot of these women had to overcome. This was like their what chant that they had to fight through, I think, from this crowd coming at this time. There were a series of kicks to Victoria, pulled her arm into the post. There was a somersault leg drop delivered to Trish, then a monkey flipped with Trish landing on Victoria's face. And then Victoria got placed on top. Trish hit the Hurricane Rana off the top. Chick kick was delivered to Victoria for a two count, pair of swinging neck breakers, and then finally hitting the Stratus faction, and getting the roll up onto Victoria, 5 minutes, 34 seconds. And then afterwards, Victoria attacked Trish with a boot to the face, and JR reiterates his line once again.
I'm telling you, she's chronically pre-menstrual.
And flat out, Ross states this feud is going to continue. So. I don't know why this, what you got out of this match, other than, folks, here was a match and there's no end to this feud yet.
No. I found the match a little sloppy,
And, you know, I have to say, I put these two at a higher standard than I would, you know, Dawn Marie and Tori, for instance. But I thought these two were maybe a little too ambitious with a lot of the moves. Like, a lot of things they were doing were involving big flips, but not being able to land flush with a lot of finishes. And beyond that, I mean, I think they're just kind of put into a buffer zone on the card anyway, between two, you know, two of the most high profile matches on the show. And the crowd just never really seemed to see it more than that. So, you know, they didn't really let it affect them though. And I thought they worked hard despite that.
Yeah, they would, their high point was, they had this hardcore match. I believe it was after this match and it was really good. It was probably the best match these two had, but I agree with you. Kind of a very ambitious stuff that they kind of planned out for this match and not exactly, gelling perfectly in this one and in a dead spot between these two matches. We go to Rikishi at the World and they show highlights of him being thrown off the Hell in a Cell back at Armageddon 2000.
They cut this out too.
Oh, they cut this out?
Yeah, on the network.
How can you cut the Rikishi out from the World? Come on. He says it sends chills up his spine and how that spot nearly ended his career. I would argue that whole heel run ended his career. And then when asked who will win the match tonight, he predicts the Taker, the Undertaker, and how he's praying for Brock.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. A great moment here of Rikishi.
Yeah.
Then we got an awesome video package for Brock and The Undertaker, including a point of view shot of the sign at Unforgiven when Lesnar got thrown into the Unforgiven sign, leading to a no contest the prior month. Then they broke The Undertaker's hand with a propane tank on television. And then they went into this wacky child singing over top of the Hell in a Cell announcement. And maybe the best just non sequitur shot of the entire pay-per-view where Brock corners Stephanie in the ring and sniffs her.
Yeah. Like he was about to make out with her.
This was so creepy.
Mm-hmm.
Just like holds his hands up on the top rope, leans in and sniffs her.
Yeah. Like he was, like a dog.
Exactly. Like he was a dog. So Lesnar and Undertaker, Hell in a Cell for the title. Cole notes how Lesnar elected to come out first,
mm-hmm.
to explain the champion coming out first, I guess to enter the cell before the Undertaker. So I guess give Cole credit for explaining this. Lesnar immediately hits the cast, gets hit with the cast and bails to the floor. And Cole is bringing up how the trainer gave The Undertaker a pain shot earlier as Lesnar is attacking the hand. This just made no sense to me. So am I to believe that The Undertaker is numb to these attacks? You know what I was supposed to believe? This painkiller segment, I think, just contradicted how this whole match was laid out where the hand was going to be worked over constantly.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to believe that even if you were to get a painkiller shot, you probably still feel something, you know, it'd still be somewhat vulnerable, but I've never taken a painkiller shot to the hand.
Well, you should try it. Your next jiu-jitsu tournament, shoot yourself up with something.
I wouldn't know where to get that.
A painkiller shot? Well, wait till the WWE's in town. You can go see the trainer, Larry, and just tell him, if you don't give me that shot, I'm going to take that needle and do it myself and see how that works.
Mm.
Lesnar was coming into this match already busted open from a cut on SmackDown and immediately got busted open from the cast. And Lesnar is run into the cell. His face is being raked against the fence. And Cole notes that this is also about the emotional torture that Lesnar and Heyman have put The Undertaker through. Emotional torture.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds like a weird, like, fetish porn or something. Taker goes to the top, tumbles down to a knee onto Lesnar on the apron. Heyman is just aimlessly putting his arm through the hole in the cell, waiting for The Undertaker to just attack him. Like he was trying to remind The Undertaker, hey, this is the spot where you injure my arm. And Taker remembered this and grabs Heyman by the tie and repeatedly just runs him into the cell. And Heyman is just busted all open here. Did more color, I think, than even Lesnar or Taker did here. He was just a mess for the rest of the next 20 minutes of this match.
Everybody bled a lot, I'd say. A
lot of blood in this Hell in a Cell match, mm-hmm. much more than you're going to see this Sunday. Heyman hands his actual belt to Lesnar, not the championship, and ties up Taker to the cell as Heyman starts yelling, "You're going to die now." And he gets beaten down with the broken hand, repeated chair shots to the cast, and eventually he rips the cast off.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing the painkillers were wearing off at this mm-hmm. point. Heyman is just looking insane here as he's clinging to life with this pool dripping down his face and just pleading, "Brock, we're losing." As Taker knocks him off the apron, hits a running boot. Taker hit a suicide dive. And, I mean, you look at The Undertaker and what he's done over the past, like, 8-9 years, especially the WrestleMania matches. I was pretty down on The Undertaker come 2002. He was not exactly the workhorse that we were seeing putting on those Shawn Michaels matches and such. So this was a huge performance, I thought, from The Undertaker in 2002, where these were not regular occurrences out of The Undertaker at this point in time. But him and Brock had phenomenal chemistry, I thought.
Yeah, I think we'd later come to find that it largely had to do with, you know, who he was paired with, because, you know, he, for the longest time, he would be paired with just these heavyweights. But we could see, like, the year before, he had that match with Angle and Rock and Vengeance that really stood out. And I thought this was no exception too, him and Brock.
So Cole and Taz are then explaining that the crowd just can't believe what they're seeing and their breath has been taken away, to explain how these guys were doing a lot of stuff and the crowd was not as into this as they were, like, the tag match or even Hunter and Kane, I thought. It just seemed that, I don't know if the cell structure was a bit of a distraction to take them out of it a little, but not as hot as you would think considering the action you were getting.
Well,
here.
Keep in mind, you know, in most of the high profile pay-per-view cell matches prior to this, you had a big spot off the top of the cage. And I think, like, even when I was watching this back then, I was just expecting, you know, these two to break out of the cage and get fight on top of it before that big spot. That was really, you know, at that point, the main allure and the of the cell matches at the time, is to see who would go off the top. And I think this was probably the first the first big one on a pay-per-view that didn't feature it. So maybe that's why.
Taker starts firing up and just repeatedly hits him with his broken right hand. As Cole just explains, he may not feel pain any longer. Taker gets dragged off the top rope before he can hit the old school. Taker then blocks an F5, hits a choke slam, gets a two count. DDT gets a two count. He calls for the last ride, but then gets run into the corner. He then comes out of the corner, hits the last ride, but Lesnar grabs the rope to break the count. And then Lesnar counters a tombstone, hoists him on his shoulders, and hits the F5 and pins Taker clean. 25 minutes, 18 seconds, and Taz did a really good job afterwards putting over the fact that Lesnar has beaten Hogan, beaten The Rock, and now he can add The Undertaker to that list. And Lesnar, after the match, grabs the title, climbs to the top of the cell with just this awesome visual to go off the show as this maniac is on top posing with his title. And great end to the show. I thought it an awesome match. Two just tremendous matches on this show.
Yeah, I thought that this was really good. And, you know, I think a lot of people maybe forget this when they talk about, you know, great Hell in a Cell matches, because it didn't feature that much fighting on the top of the cage or any big spot like that. But I thought what they did was they managed to work a really good, violent, very violent street fight. And, you know, the finish I thought was very good. I thought overall, you know, it's sort of underrated. And perhaps, you know, a match that the quality, it's hard to expect, you know, them to be able to achieve that, you know, let's say, this year at WrestleMania, but I'm sure they wanted something closer to this than what they actually got. But if you wanted to see a good Brock and Taker match, I think you would look towards this.
So if you're ever looking for a snapshot at the WWE in 2002, this show is really good for that. You got to see the very best and the very worst of the WWE in 2002 on this show. They ran the gamut of of quality. And I really enjoyed this show. All that said, even the horrendous angles, I get a kick out of watching the stuff back. So I gave this show a 8 out of 10, really paced by those two matches, including the tag, which was just a phenomenal tag match of four guys who were just completely on for 22 minutes.
Yeah, I also give it 8.
Wow, agreement. That's not very often we have that on this show. Well, let's see what you had to say. We'll go over to the feedback thread, and we kick things off with Christian. Not that Christian. I remember this show very well, back when it was first shown to me and a buddy. We stayed up until 4 in the morning to watch it live. It happened to fall on a school holiday, so we could watch it. I was against them getting rid of the IC title, as I loved that title. I understood that they wanted to get rid of some titles, as they had way too many, but I felt you could have kept the IC title around, and it would have come back, and it would come back in less than a year. Me and my buddy were physically shocked when seeing how badly Taker bled in the main event. Boy, was he flowing. I still love that Hell in a Cell match. Felt that made Lesnar a true main event guy. As good as that match was, I still prefer the tag title match 4 of the SmackDown 6, showing what they could do. Just an incredible match. 7 out of 10 show.
We got Alan Jones, who says, the show overall was good but not great. The tag match is the only real must-see match here, and the rest is fairly passable. Taker-Lesnar is worth a watch, but I found it a little disappointing as it never really got into top gear. One thing that I really come away with from the show is how awful the writing at the WWE was at this time. A lot of the storylines are handled poorly. Katie Vick, the Dawn Marie Al Wilson thing. I wasn't with MB6. Sexenced to death by Don Marie, and then Tori and Don would fight at Al's funeral. Even more successful storylines were badly handled. 6.5 out of 10.
Ronaldo from Italy, the Hell in a Cell was some kind of novelty, as this was probably the first time the cage was used as a weapon and not just as a trampoline. Kind of like today, but with blood, which is a nice compliment. The rise of Brock and Taker selling made the main event a match for the ages. No disrespect to their WrestleMania encounter, but this match was dirty, gritty, raw, and put Brock on the map, in my opinion. Rest of the card is okay, still better than most of the rap they give us nowadays. The Ray Edge versus Angle Benoit was pure art. I still remember the final minutes and how back in the day I thought, this is something more. No point in an IC World title unification match. Dawn and Tori fighting over corpses is fine, just for the boobs. Very classy, Ronaldo.
We go to Will, who says, as Brock was getting his feet as a credible character and in a fine match with Taker, Triple H vs. Kane was a good match, but nothing special. My question is it due to the PG era that the WWE is in, that the WWE cannot have a badass, totally outrageous, devil-like heel? Who can outrage the crowd, really piss fans off, make proper heat? CM Punk with the urn on the ramp with Taker was a moment. The business needs that heel magic, a heel so bad that the fans cannot make him cool, as that seems to be the latest trend. Who do you reckon that guy could be?
I don't think there's anything stopping them. I mean, there's certain avenues you can't go down in this current climate that's going to give you certain heat. But I mean, I think that there's nothing preventing guys from just being more creative with how you generate that kind of heat from the crowd. It doesn't have to necessarily involve bludgeoning someone or, I think there's different ways around it. I think CM Punk was a fantastic heel that year plus while he was holding the title. It cut great promos, wasn't, you know, violating, you know, the parameters that the WWE operates in. I think it's just a matter of being a creative performer and knowing how to get that heat. Heyman's another example.
I'm trying to figure out who Will is referring to on this show that kind of exemplified that.
Yeah, if you're bringing up Triple H or even Brock Lesnar, I mean, I didn't think they were, I mean, really, like, what was the TV-14 content they were doing, like stupid shit with Tracy and Katie Vick. I mean, I don't want to see that now. I don't think that would add anything to a heel character. Yeah. So, I mean, the things that got heels over and have in the past, there's some stuff that is different now, but I think there's a lot of stuff that you can still utilize very effectively. Matt writes in from Detroit. I threw my DVD in, and the first thing I watched was a DVD extra, the Trick or Pete Rose Halloween commercial promoting this show. WWE also included on that DVD a confidential piece on the history of the IC title and a lot of wrestlers who weren't happy that the title was temporarily shelved. As for the pay-per-view, shocked that Jericho wasn't hurt when that rope snapped. Tajiri and Noble was a crazy love triangle that led to a great match. Noble was a great cruiserweight champion, brought in Nunzio during this feud.
I was weary back in 02 of Benoit and Angle teaming. I was glad to be wrong. The SmackDown 6 ruled, and that little segment pre-match with Angle and Benoit beating up Chavo while Eddie was great. Hell in a Cell match was why I wanted Cena versus Brock 3. All right, gives us 8 out of 10.
Okay, we go to Aram from Denmark, who says, I love the tag team divisions of this era. Great matches, which I'm sure you guys are going to talk about. If I'm right, they did a great four-way match a month or two later with Eddie instead of Rey and Mysterio. Booker T and Goldust is probably my all-time favorite odd couple tag team with numerous fantastic segments, including At the Movies, Star Wars, and with The Rock, to name a few.
Bruce from Vancouver, watching this card brought back some memories, many of which I wish had stayed buried. At the time, I couldn't understand WWE's willingness to give so much screen time to Al Wilson, a black hole of charisma and acting ability with a vaguely Kermit the Frog sounding voice. 12 years later, it's still just as befuddling. Did Vince feel the product wasn't already meeting its quota of elderly men getting it on with divas? As for Katie Vick, I don't think I can say anything that hasn't been said hundreds of times before. Storylines aside, the actual matches on this card were very solid. Flair and RVD was an odd pairing, but worked okay. And I'd forgotten how much I enjoyed Vintage Tajiri. The second tag match was a fantastic spot fest with all manner of great false finishes and reversals, but thinking about the toll wrestling would take on each of those four men's careers, health, and lives made it a bit bittersweet. On a side note, I thought the montage showcasing the history of the IC belt in terms of the matches and feuds it's been at the center of was great. What I wouldn't give to see something like that attached to the belt today. 6, Ric Flair actually knows how to use a sledgehammer shots out of 10.
Dwayne in Ireland. The WWE tag title match is one of my favorite matches ever. The tournament may have featured some awful teams, but the final match here made it all worthwhile. And to top it off, Taker and Lesnar reinvented the Cell match with a gritty, realistic, believable fight, officially moving away from the previous stunt bump reputation it had in previous years, and set the bar for the next 5 to 6 years before the Hell in a Cell match was completely watered down. 8 Big Show thumbs up his ass out of 10.
And final one from David Duffenberg. I'm not even sure where to begin with this show. There's a lot of pure gold mixed with a lot of crap. The tag title match was outstanding, in my opinion. It's the best straight-up tag match in the WWE that I can remember seeing. It flowed perfectly, and I didn't even remember who won. So even 12 years later, it was like watching a live show with an exciting result. I've been watching a lot of the old Nitros on the network, so seeing Rey Mysterio in this match made me want to nominate him for the Putski Award. He definitely added some mass since those days. Hell in a Cell was just an awesome brawl. They made the gimmick feel like it was needed and not just there for show. It proved that death-defying stunts aren't needed to make the Cell an awesome match. These two hated each other, a huge cage was placed around the two, and they beat the living crap out of each other for our enjoyment. I don't feel like bringing up the awful parts of the show because I'm sure they've been brought up enough already. The SmackDown portions of the show really saved this for me, and that was what I remembered at the end. I'll give this a generous 8 out of 10. The SmackDown tag title match was just that damn good. And that will wrap up our look at No Mercy 2002 on the eve of the Katie Vick Triple H funeral parlor segment, which we did review a while back. If you want to go to the archives where we have all of our shows, all of them, Review Away, Raw, Impact, The Law, they're all up there. If you sign up for the Law message board, you can go back and listen to our thoughts on the Katie Vick segment from the very next night. With Seth Mates, no less, who was part of the creative team at that glorious time in WWE history. So that's worth checking out. But way before we end off this show, some announcements to make. We're going to be doing a contest, a Halloween contest. Do you want to share the details?
Yes. Well, we just kind of – didn't we do that already at the beginning of the –
Oh, yeah, that's right. We did, actually.
Well, we'll repeat it. But basically, we are having a contest. Some of you have requested a contest, so we are going to do one. And all we're simply asking for is Halloween's coming up. We know a lot of you guys will be dressing up as wrestling-related characters in your costumes. So we just want you guys to send us your photos of you dressed up in some type of wrestling-related costume. And basically the best costume will win. And I think to verify that it is you in the costume, we are just simply asking everybody to hold up a sign or some piece of paper with your costume that, what should it say?
Review Away.
Review Away. And make sure you spell it right, because if you spell it wrong,
you're dead.
You're dead. You just have a...
You're Katie Vick'd.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be a costume? Nobody would get it.
You'd have to buy some spaghetti.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, John and I will be the ultimate deciders here. I mean,
we're looking for some creativity. I think, you know, what are we, like, obscurity is definitely, might definitely get
we
some
always,
points. But.
We always value creativity. So you can post this. We'll put the thread up for all the submissions to go. You can either post a picture or a video. It's up to you, whatever's easier. And then we'll announce the winner on Review a Raw on Monday night, November the 3rd, after Halloween weekend, to the best wrestling-related costume. So there you have it. Make sure to put up your review away sign. It can be on a napkin. And remember how to spell our beloved Way's name. Or review. Don't fuck that one up and don't screw up A. That's the easiest one. Yeah. That's a gimme. So that's our big contest to announce. And then next week on this show, to keep with the Halloween theme, we're going to go back to Halloween Havoc of 1994. 20 years ago, Way, Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair had a battle inside of a steel cage with the loser retiring forever. A retirement match between Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair in 1994.
Oh my.
Always a fun time to go back and look at the wonderful world of WCW. So that will be our review for next week. Halloween contest thread, that will be going up this week at lawradio.proboards.com. It's free to sign up on the message boards. As we said, all our shows go up there. All of our archives are up there, all free of charge, and you can chat with other law listeners. So that's going to wrap things up. As always, you can check out not just the message board, but also liveaudiowrestling.com. All our regular shows are going to be up there this weekend on the law. We'll have a review of Hell in a Cell. Wei Ting, maybe he will join us, though that is usually a game day decision for Mr. Ting, and hopefully you're feeling better by this Sunday, Way.
Thanks, man. I should be.
Is there any soothing music that might make you feel better as we end off this particular review?
Whatever you're listening to.
Well, that's always a great time to go back to the wonderful Billboard charts of 2002 from the week of October the 20th. And check out what the world was listening to as they pondered where this Katie Vick angle could possibly go the very next night on Raw. So that is all for us. Thanks for tuning into this review, and we will speak with you later this week.
Seen him before.